one of the bloodiest conflicts in European history. You may have never heard about it in a history book. It's a significant conflict. It was called the Peasants' War or the Peasants' Uprising. It took place right smack dab in the middle of that era we called the Reformation, right near the beginning of the Reformation, in fact. And it was significant in shaping the events that came together, that coalesced, the historical events that coalesced and moved the Reformation forward. The Peasants' Revolt. We're going to talk about social reform and the Peasants' Uprising here in the first hour of Issues, Etc. Was the Peasants' Revolt this bloody conflict in Europe? Was it the result of the teachings of Martin Luther? We'll find that out in the first hour here with Dr. Robert Kolb. He'll join us in just a moment. In the second hour, open lines for your questions, your comments. I'd like to talk a little bit about General Boykin. General Boykin made some statements this summer. They were recently reported by NBC and other news agencies. Statements that are causing a lot of trouble, that have sparked an investigation in the Pentagon. General Boykin is, well, we might say he is highly placed in military intelligence. He has made a habit throughout his military career, an illustrious one, by the way. He's made the habit of speaking to church groups. He's a professing Christian. I'll share some of the things that he said and some of the things that you might not be reading that he said. It appears the Pentagon edited his public apology for statements he made about Islam. And the things that were edited out, I thought, were the best stuff. We'll have that in the second hour of Issues, Etc. today. Open lines for your questions and your comments. Then, in the third hour, if you glance at the cover of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, we'll be covering all of those stories in one form or another for you in the third hour of Issues, Etc. We'll start out talking about the U.S. Senate's approval yesterday of the ban on partial birth abortion. Doug Johnson of National Right to Life will be our guest for a few minutes. Then we'll get an update on the euthanasia case of Terry Schiavo, Wesley Smith. As he joined us yesterday, will be kind enough to join us again in the third hour to find out what's going on there. And we'll be talking about the beatification of Mother Teresa. Ken Woodward will be our guest, religion editor for Newsweek magazine. Some conversation on matters pertaining to the Vatican in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Robert Kolb is our first guest to talk about Martin Luther and social reform, the Peasants' Uprising. He is Mission Professor of Systematic Theology and Director of the Institute for Mission Studies at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He's author of several books, including Martin Luther as Prophet, Teacher, Hero. He joins us from England. Dr. Kolb, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's really good to be back. Actually, I'm in Germany, but all those European places look a lot alike.
That's okay. We will change this on the list here. So you join us from Germany. What are you doing in Germany, Dr. Kolb?
Right now I'm concentrating on a little bit of research, though I've been doing quite a bit of traveling, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, trying to help churches there with the continuing ed for pastors and also for laity and little seminary level teaching.
How significantly is the topic of our conversation for this hour, the Peasants' Uprising or the Peasants' War, remembered in Germany?
Oh, it's been a significant topic of conversation since the middle of the 19th century, at least. It was, of course, a very important topic of conversation in the 16th century, not only because it was the event that you depict, but also because particularly Luther's Roman Catholic opponents made a great deal of it in trying to battle against Luther. But in the middle of the 19th century, Friedrich Engels, Karl Marx's right-hand man, discovered the Peasants' Revolt as an important part of the Marxist explanation of early modern history. And so at first Luther was the villain who stood against the rising proletariat. Then later he became a necessary step in the bourgeois stage of the march toward a proletarian revolution. And so the Peasants' War, the Peasants' Revolt, has been an important part of Reformation historiographical discussion for 150 years.
Let's see if we can clear up some of the misperceptions, some of the ignorance about social reform and the Peasants' Revolt during the time of the Reformation, and then later we'll come back to that issue of Marxism's misuse of Luther and this significant event in European history. Give us a general historical context for the Peasants' War.
There probably would have been peasants' revolts in the 1520s in Germany if there had been no Reformation. I don't want to suggest that the peasant hearing of Luther's message played no role, but there had been a series of peasants' revolts in various parts of Germany, particularly intense in 1503 and 1513. But the series of revolts in 1524-25, actually going into 1526, took place over about a third of the German-speaking territory at the time. And so they were the most significant, the highest number of casualties. We shouldn't exaggerate the number of casualties, but any number of casualties and more is too many. And so there was an impact certainly on society. Some scholars would say that there was not as much impact on the spread of the Reformation as the Roman Catholics had hoped in the 16th century. And you often read in the Western Civ textbooks that the Reformation did continue to make progress among the German peasants in the late 1520s, 1530s, 1540s. But it certainly did have some impact.
Now, the term peasant implies a certain social order, a certain civil order as well, that probably most of us would find very unfamiliar and offensive to modern sensibilities. Can you describe what Europe was emerging from the Middle Ages at the time of the Reformation in terms of how city-states were governed, the function of princes and nobility and the peasantry?
Oh, that's a large order, Todd. But let me say a few words about the peasants. First of all, the vast majority of Europeans in 1525, the year of the sort of climax of the revolt, probably 90% of them, certainly 85% of Europeans were peasants. That meant that they were agricultural by vocation. They were, for the most part, in some way bound in the feudal system to a lord. Some of them had their actual persons bound to a lord. Some of them had the land on which they farmed bound to the lord. It didn't make a whole lot of difference because a peasant needed land. The land needed the peasants to work it, and the whole social system needed the relationship between the lords who gave leadership and the peasants who fed everyone. Peasants lived in villages. Farming still in Germany is not organized as it is in the United States with farmsteads scattered across the countryside. But the peasants lived in villages, and the lord provided them with protection, with a justice system, with a church and the like, and the peasants then had to pay taxes. In the late 15th century, in the early 16th century, in many parts of Germany, the taxes were going up. The burden was felt more heavily. And in addition to that, there was an introduction of something like ancient Roman law. There actually was the reintroduction of the so-called Justinian Code of the 6th century, which introduced certain legal disadvantages for the peasantry. For instance, in the common law, the Germanic common law of the 14th, 15th century, there was the right of the whole village to certain streams, forests, meadowlands. And in the new Roman law, there was no common land anymore. All land had to belong to one individual. And at that point, the lords, whether they be princes or local knights, took advantage of seizing what had been, or managing at least what had been, a land that the whole village had managed before. So there were, for a number of reasons, there were social tensions between the peasantry and their lords. In addition to that, we ought to see that within a peasant village, there were actually three social levels. The very poor, who had maybe no land at all or only a very little land, and were really something like day laborers, a sort of middle class, and then there were among the peasants an upper class that had more land, had more property, more animals, and therefore more wealth.
So this is a complex system, a social system, that had functioned, well, off and on in Europe for a long, long time. What initially led to this time called the Peasants' Uprising?
I think it was a combination of economic factors along with the legal factors that I just talked about. The peasants felt that some of their traditional rights were being taken care of, and they were very important rights. They were the rights to gather wood for the stove in the forest, and the right to fish, and the right to hunt. The lords wanted to hunt themselves on the meadows and in the forests. So there was a loss of legal status. And then I think it can't be denied that it was a period of a certain amount of intellectual ferment. It was not just Luther. One German scholar, 60, 70, maybe 80 years ago, wrote a very interesting analysis of how the writings of the great humanist Erasmus, Desiderius Erasmus of Rotterdam, had been translated into German by certain Swiss preachers, actually, and had given an ideological basis for revolt. But it's also important to see that there was a sense of the freedom of the gospel that the peasants took from Luther and tried to translate into a social program.
Did Luther approve of taking his theology and applying it to civil affairs?
That's also a very complex problem, because so often Protestants in the United States today sort of think that Luther believed in the separation of church and state and a kind of independent realm of state that the church has nothing to do with. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Luther simply, as a man of the 16th century, could not have conceived of a world in which church and state could be separate. Luther's first reaction, interestingly enough, to the peasants' revolt, there was a group of peasants in South Germany that authored 12 articles and called upon Luther and Melanchthon, his colleague, and a number of other prominent theologians to be the judge of their cause. And so Luther wrote a reply in which he was, first of all, very critical of the lords. He said that many of the knights and the counts and dukes had oppressed their people. They had violated God's commission to them to be the protectors and fathers of their people, the subjects that God had placed under them. So he was highly critical of the political authorities of the time. At the same time, he had a great fear of violence, as did almost all well-placed people in early 16th century Europe. They had really no record of successful revolts. The revolts of the ancient world, there hadn't been many revolts in the Middle Ages, but in the ancient world, the ancient historians reported that revolts brought chaos and then they brought tyranny. They almost never brought improvement. So there was Luther had, like everybody in his time, had a great fear of peasant violence, and so he pleaded for peace, and then he also said that the peasants had really gotten all mixed up about what the gospel really is. The gospel is the forgiveness of sins. The gospel is the restoration of the sinner's relationship with his or her creator. And the gospel enables us to be Christ's people again. And then, as a result of that, we are to love our neighbors. But we are not to understand that the gospel itself is going to solve every problem in a sinful world. And so he had a theological critique. Then after he heard more about the violence that the peasants were inflicting upon noble families. There were a couple of instances of the slaughter of the inhabitants of castles and the like. Luther wrote a plea to the Saxon authorities. His prince, Frederick the Wise, was dying at this time, and he wrote a plea to Frederick's brother John to intervene and to restore order and to use every method possible to stop peasant violence and to restore order. And then after that, he wrote an explanation of why that had been necessary at the time that he wrote it, because he really did have fears that total chaos was breaking out.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Kolb about Martin Luther and social reform, in particular the peasants' uprising during the time of the Reformation. Dr. Kolb, before we get deeper into Luther's place in this event in history, what was the scope, the final toll, when all was said and done, after the peasants' uprising was put down?
I think in many, well, first of all, we have to realize that about a third of Germany was affected by the revolt. So in two-thirds of Germany, there probably wasn't very much change. But in a number of places, there were severe retributions by the nobility and the ducal governments, simply because they had this great fear. And so to end the possibility of further peasant violence, they were quite severe. There was a deepening of the enforcement of the new Roman law. So in many ways, the peasant communities did see their rights really permanently taken away and never restored. The feudal system really never came back. It was gradually disappearing in the 1500s and 1600s into the 18th century. But there was a blow to peasant rights and to communal rights that from which the peasantry never recovered. On the other hand, there was a return of agricultural prosperity, is maybe too much said, but improvement until the time of the Thirty Years' War. In the period between 1618 and 1648, again, many parts of Germany were severely damaged by warring troops, both from Sweden and Denmark in the north and from various parts of Germany. And then finally, French forces invaded toward the middle of the 17th century.
And at the end of the Peasants' Revolt, are there any accurate estimates as to a death count, how we measure in terms of human lives lost?
I'm sure there are, but I don't know them. In comparison to modern losses, of course, they don't seem like much, but for that time, it was a shock that sent ripples through the whole population of Germany.
Did some at the time try to pin the blame for the peasants' uprising on Luther himself?
Yes, that was a favorite Roman Catholic theme really for the rest of the 16th century. As I said, it's not completely false. On the other hand, if Luther had not been there, Erasmus might have had to take the blame, at least according to the scholar I referred to. And if neither Erasmus or Luther had been there, there could well have been other factors that would have led to not the first, but another peasants' revolt in 1525. There had already been, as I said, a number of revolts in the late 15th, early 16th century.
And then let's talk a bit in the few moments before we go to this break, with about 2 minutes, Luther's views on civil obedience.
Well, because he lived in what was perceived to be a very fragile society, and because he believed that God had placed a definite social order in this world, He was not so naive as to think that the feudal order was the only order that had ever been. He recognized the differences between the feudal order and life in ancient Rome or life in amongst the Hebrews. But he believed that God had established order, and because order was so precious, it was the basis of anybody's being able to function. He believed that all people should obey the superiors that that God had placed over them in a social order. He did, 15 years later, come to conclude that certain kinds of revolt were permissible, the revolt of the so-called lesser magistrates, the dukes, the counts, against the emperor would be permissible if the emperor did not fulfill his God-given responsibilities. So Luther did change his mind about the legitimacy of certain kinds of active resistance against governmental authorities that were failing to be the governmental authorities God had called them to be.
Dr. Robert Kolb is our guest. We're talking about Lutheran social reform. When we come back from the break, we will spend some time talking about other social reforms that were encouraged by Luther, in particular marriage and family life. We'll see what Luther had to say about those things during the time of the Reformation. And we'll talk about the radical reformers a little bit, those who felt that Luther simply didn't go far enough, those who thought that the Reformation, the gospel, meant a necessary overturning of all orders, among them Thomas Minster. Dr. Robert Kolb is Missions Professor of Systematic Theology and Director of the Institute for Mission Studies at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. He's authored several books, including Martin Luther as Prophet, Teacher, Hero. He joins us from Germany. Much of what we're talking about can be found in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. This book is called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. It walks through the events of the Reformation, including an entire chapter on social reform and the Peasants' Uprising, through the writings of Luther and the other reformers. Now, if you call Concordia Publishing House in the next 90 minutes, you can order Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. The book costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. The number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. You can also find out more about the book by visiting our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross. If you prefer to go in and purchase it right over the counter, visit one of the two locations the Concordia Publishing House has as bookstores, one at 3558 South Jefferson here in St. Louis, the other here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. The book is called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Issuesetc.org. When you go in, when you call, when you write, make sure you mention Issues Etc. The book is called Lift High This Cross. It's our book of the month for October. When we come back, more on Martin Luther and social reform and the Peasants' Uprising with Dr. Robert Kolb.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Faith alone, that was Martin Luther's cry, wasn't it? Yes, but is that all Luther had to say? Was there more to the Reformation than this? And why was it necessary for Luther to assert that we are saved by grace through faith for the sake of Christ alone? Our new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. You can order Lift High This Cross online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information about the book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Hindus who worship millions of different gods and idols. Find out why. The different gods in Hinduism may look like humans, animals, wind, fire, or sun. The idea is that each deity fulfills people's desires, but with the same quality of blessing like one god. One source for Hindu information claims that they believe in one god who has no form. The website HinduNet describes their belief in a formless and all-blissful god. But they believe that concentrating on various forms of ideal personalities can help someone recognize that formless god. They write that Hinduism is flexible and offers many ways to develop spiritual ideas to meet individual needs. Pray for Hindus, especially those living in India who have little chance to hear about Jesus Christ, God who came to live among man. Learn more about Hindus by logging on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Today, October 22nd, marks the 25th anniversary of Pope John Paul II's installation as Pontiff of the Roman Church. In all the media coverage, I have not picked up discussion of one of the most important changes that has happened this last quarter century. That's the triumph in Western cultures of postmodern thinking. For centuries, people believed there are absolute truths. No longer the case. The truth, we are now told, is unknowable. A demonstration. It is a fact that the papacy, not necessarily the man who occupies it, but the institution of the papacy has been divisive in the history of Christianity. Just saying that rouses postmodern ire. You have your opinion, I have mine. All roads lead to the same place. Who says so, you or God? Both the Hebrew and Christian Bible are about conflict, and not the postmodern version of challenged human opinion and pride, but about God's real conflict with his wandering creatures. 2 Corinthians 5:18 says, God reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. A service to humanity you and I could render would be to disagree without walking away from one another. How is truth served when we stop talking face to face?
The reason an unbeliever could never use free will to believe in Jesus Christ, he'd have to make a choice to become enslaved to Jesus Christ, because that's what I am. I'm Jesus' slave, and it doesn't bother me. Oh, it bothers my old Adam. The new man loves to be a slave to Jesus when I realize how much he had become a slave for me. He died on the cross for my sins.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. If you have a question or a comment on the Peasants' Uprising or social reform during the time of the Reformation, feel free to give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I know there have been a few non-live hours this week due to my travel and speaking schedule. We are coming to you live this Wednesday afternoon, November the 22nd, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Robert Kolb is our guest. We're talking about Martin Luther and social reform and the Peasants' Uprising. A few more questions on the Peasants' Uprising, Dr. Kolb. First of all, there was a bit of a reaction, and I want you to speak a little bit about an event called the Diet of Speyer, that actually two hearings at Speyer that had seemed to be, at least in my mind, reactions to some of the issues raised by the Peasants' Uprising in terms of religion. Tell us about it.
Well, in 1526, within months of the end of the last of the revolts, the Diet, the legislature of the German Empire met, and Charles V, who had outlawed Luther and Lutheranism in 1521 at the Diet of Worms, gave a command that his princes, the dukes and counts, and the independent cities under him should enforce the Edict of Worms to eradicate Lutherans and Lutheranism, should enforce that according to their conscience. He meant by that they should get rid of Lutheran teaching and reform. The evangelical, the Protestant, well, they weren't called Protestants yet, the Lutheran princes, of course, interpreted according to their conscience as permission, actually, to continue their reform. So in 1529, when the legislature met again in Speyer, city on the Rhine in South Germany, Charles V tried to impress upon them their duty to suppress Lutheranism, and they gave a confession of faith under the Latin, one of the Latin words for confession of faith, a protestatio, and after that the Lutheran princes were called Protestants. It wasn't a protest, it was really a testimony for, pro, their faith in Jesus Christ. And so in his effort to restore order, to make sure that the order that had been restored would last in his empire, the Emperor Charles V in 1526 did try to make sure that the Lutheran revolt would be the theological revolt would be suppressed.
So this was essentially trying to deal with, at least from the imperial side, trying to deal with the theological revolt that was taking place at the same time, although not always directly related to the civil revolts.
Yes, though in the minds of authorities, all authorities, religious and civil, were authorities, and if somebody could disobey the Pope, that same person could disobey the emperor. And so Charles V was trying to hold his social system, his social order together.
Tell us a bit about those who believed that Luther in his, who would have found Luther's encouragement for people to exercise obedience to civil authorities, would have found that a little weak need and believed Luther didn't go far enough, namely one of the radical reformers, Thomas Münster.
Yeah, Thomas Münster is actually a former student of Luther's, had been briefly at least at the University of Wittenberg. But Münster was influenced by a long tradition of what we might call radical reform, though in many ways it was very conservative. From at least the year 1000, there had been groups who were biblicistic. They didn't want the tradition of the church to rule. They wanted the Bible alone. But they were moralistic. They had no concept of grace and faith as Luther did, but they believed that to follow the Bible is to follow God's moral commands, and that would bring you nearer to God. They were anti-clerical because they saw in the priests the enforcement of an old system that was oppressive. And because they were anti-clerical, they were also anti-sacramental, since the sacraments, particularly the Lord's Supper in the Mass of the Middle Ages, was an instrument of keeping people in line. And they were then also millennialists. They believed that Christ would come soon and that he would introduce a new kingdom. And Thomas Münster came out of a background something like that and represented a theology of that sort. It's interesting that the Marxists actually have chosen Münster as their great hero in the revolt of the proletariat. Thomas Münster was a spiritualist. He was a very religious man. He wanted a concept of the introduction of the kingdom of God, nothing like Karl Marx. And he was not particularly concerned about the social injustices. Luther actually had written more calling the princes to exercise justice in the social sphere. Münster simply wanted the kingdom of God, divine law, to be enforced here on this earth. And so he became a prominent leader in Luther's home area in Thuringia, and was executed on the battlefield, actually, at the end of the one battle in which the Thuringian or Saxon peasants met the armies of the princes.
Tell us about other elements of social reform at the time of the Reformation that Luther wholeheartedly approved of, namely marriage and family.
Well, there are a whole series of social reforms that Luther favored in his early calls for theological and ecclesiastical reform. He often included a call for reform in other parts of life, especially within the societal structures. In his open letter to the German nobility in 1520, he discouraged the importation of spices because it was a luxury good. He criticized luxurious clothing. He wanted simplicity in clothing because he thought it was a waste of money. And so he was concerned about a number of social issues. In the Middle Ages, and also interestingly enough in Renaissance humanism, there was a tendency to see women as almost a subspecies. Some of the humanists later in the 16th century actually advanced that idea, not very many of them. But Luther saw that God had made men for women and women for men, and he criticized the practice of celibacy for monks and nuns and priests in the late medieval church. And so he did a great deal to exalt the status of marriage and to emphasize the cooperation and equality even of men and women within the family in many ways. And sometimes feminists criticize him actually for putting women on a pedestal and not opening all kinds of opportunities for them. But compared to medieval and Renaissance humanist ideas about family and particularly the status of women, Luther does make an important step both in the direction of I think, a biblical view and in a more modern view of family life.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Kolb. Luther and social reform is the subject of this hour. How significant was Luther's own marriage? He was somewhat hesitant to do this while he was encouraging others to enter into this holy estate. It took a little cajoling for him to do it himself.
Well, he was an outlaw, and he figured that he would not die a natural death, that somehow the imperial police would catch him and burn him as the ecclesiastical authorities had threatened to do it, condemned him to death at the stake. So he didn't think he was the ideal husband. But his marriage was really very important as a model and also for his own ministry, because he and Katharina von Bora, his wife, ministered to each other, and her encouragement, her speaking the gospel to him, her forgiving his sins, was a very important part of the piety that developed as he grew older, and that he reflected in his writings and modeled for his students, because he always had students around the table in the black cloister there in Wittenberg. It's important also to say that it wasn't just the improvement of a view of marriage that made a social contribution. His emphasis on education, his attempt to battle against capitalist practices that were economically abusive, in a number of ways, his social views were biblical, but from at least a certain modern perspective, enlightened and something we could listen to, given the change in our situation between the 16th century and today. Something we could listen to today.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live this October the 22nd. Harold's on the line from St. Charles. Harold, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, I wish I could have gotten in a little earlier with this question. You know, Dr. Kolb discussed about the peasants uprising against mainly the nobility, but also they really took it out, too, on the clergy, the bishops and the abbots and whatnot, because, you know, they owned a fair amount of land, too. And that, so I wonder if Dr. Kolb could hold forth on that one.
Thank you very much, Harold. Dr.
Kolb. Hi, Harold. You're absolutely right. There were, in the German Empire from the time of Charlemagne on, actually, there were abbots and bishops who not only had their spiritual duties, but actually had usually parts of their own archbishopric or the monastic lands, in which they were secular lords as well. And so the peasants didn't make a distinction between bishops and dukes or abbots and nobles. They tried to claim their rights against their secular authorities, whether they were ordained or not ordained.
And what role did Luther's penning of the small catechism in particular, what role did he envision for that when it came to family life? He does begin each heading, as a father should teach his children.
Yeah, he understood the calling of parents as including the instruction of children in many of the church constitutions of the 1520s. From about 1530 on, the time of the Augsburg Confession, many of those Lutheran church constitutions required couples that wanted to marry to be able to recite the catechism because they couldn't read, and so they had to be able to recite it themselves in order to instruct their children. And Luther's own catechism, his little handbook that we call the Small Catechism, as well as his emphasis on families having devotions and instructing their children, really were a very important part over the rest of the 16th and into the 17th century, an important part of the development of Lutheran piety.
Right around.
So the Small Catechism really occupies a key role, and it was written in part in his reaction to the ignorance that he found in peasant villages when in 1527 and 28 he and Melanchthon and others were commissioned by their elector, their duke, their prince, to visit the parishes of Saxony.
When he visited, what did he find?
Well, he was shocked. I think he was a little bit naive myself because he grew up in a family that had peasant roots, even though his father was a copper smelter. Knew the peasant life of his grandparents and his aunts and uncles and his cousins, and he should have known that village life was pretty raw and rough. But he had hoped that the gospel would make changes faster than it did, though he should have known from his own theology that the sinner in the saint asserts itself from time to time. At any rate, he was shocked. He said some pretty nasty things about his fellow Germans and the way they were living. And so he found it just absolutely necessary to get a program of instruction that would blanket the countryside, we might say, and he wanted to work through parents so that they would be helping with the instruction of their children through the small catechism.
What role did the table of duties, which is the last part of Luther's Small Catechism, what was it, and what role did it play in Luther's reform within family and marriage?
I think that while we often call the Small Catechism a handbook for Christian teaching or doctrine, it's really more than that. It's a handbook for Christian living because it not only had the so-called five or six chief parts of Christian doctrine, but it also had a section on personal devotional life with the prayers for morning, evening, mealtime. And it had this, I like to say, table of Christian callings. You took Luther's concept that we are called by God in our homes, in our occupations, in our community life, in our congregations, to serve our neighbor, to serve God by serving our neighbor, and that God has set up the whole structure of society in order that we might love one another and thereby take care of one another and keep God's world going. And so it seems to me that what we have in the six chief parts of Christian teaching or doctrine is law in the Ten Commandments, gospel in the creed, kind of framework for getting the word across in the treatment of the sacraments. And then that goes on to say, with this gift from God, you are to live out a life that has meditation and prayer, and then a life that serves the neighbor.
And Luther's work on the German language also seems significant here as well. He not only translated, he not only wrote in German for the people, but he translated the New Testament and the Holy Scriptures into the German language. How significant was Luther's work on crafting really kind of the modern German language in the social system, the civil society?
Well, of course, it was very important because a language, a culture, lives from its language and from its ability to communicate. And Luther took the Saxon court language, and he had a fine literary sense. He understood how words work and how concepts can be gotten across effectively. And so the latest scholarship, scholars always have to react against what former scholars have said. There are some scholars who say we have overestimated his role in shaping the German language. There were other important authors in the 16th and 17th century, too. But given that fact, it still can be said that Germans today speak a language that Luther largely shaped.
Finally, coming back to the subject we started at, did Luther's teachings cause the peasant revolts of the time of the Reformation?
Oh, I think that's giving Luther too much credit. We do have to remember that in his time, people weren't bombarded by media. They had relatively little outside their own village that influenced them at all. So when one of these newfangled devices called a pamphlet or a tract landed in the local bar and the one peasant who could read it to the whole village, yes, the author of that tract had a lot of influence in the village, or at least was the occasion for something happening. People didn't always understand Luther any better than you and I understand some of the politicians or the novelists or whoever we read or hear. But Luther himself wrote over 20% of the publications that were published in all of Germany around 1520-25 in that period. His followers were responsible for probably something close to another 20%. And so Luther's ideas were very important. But again, as I said, the frustration was there in particularly that middle class of peasants who had some hope of improving their situation and were seeing some of their benefits being eroded both by higher taxes and by the deprivation of certain traditional peasant rights. And so while I think Luther's writings played a role, the writings of other people, I've mentioned Erasmus, for instance, played a role, and just the entire socio-political situation played a role.
Can we lay things like the rise of Nazi Germany or the success of communism in the last century, two movements that used Luther or misused Luther, can we lay those movements at Luther's doorstep?
No, when I did my doctoral work at the University of Wisconsin, I studied with George Mossy, who is one of probably the American expert on fascism in the 20th century. He was a German-born Jewish scholar, and I learned a great deal from him, and I learned how complex the origins of modern fascism and specifically modern Nazism are, and Luther played a very inconsiderable role in its origins. He was used somewhat, particularly his tragic and unfortunate and inexcusable anti-Jewish statements. They were used by the Nazi propagandists, but of course not as much as one might expect, because at least one wing of the Nazi movement wanted to go back to a German paganism, wanted to eradicate Christianity, and therefore had no interest in making Luther important. There's been perhaps, especially with the Nazis, yes, some use of Luther, but we shouldn't exaggerate it.
With only 1 minute, you're joining us from Germany today, Dr. Kolb. What is the state of Lutheranism in Germany as we speak?
Well, there's a widespread respect for him and gratitude for him, but I'm afraid that his message is not terribly well understood by the general population. Germany, like much of Scandinavia and actually most of Western Europe, has enjoyed material blessings to such an extent that that the church plays an ever less significant role in the lives of people. And this is mission territory in Western Europe just as much as Eastern Europe is today.
Dr. Robert Kolb, thank you for your time and staying up to join us here on Issues, Etc.
Well, we're not that far away, so it's not been a problem at all. It's always a delight to chat with you, Todd, and with your listeners, and I wish you every blessing in this week in which we thank God for the blessing of Martin Luther.
Dr. Robert Kolb is Mission Professor of Systematic Theology and Director of the Institute for Mission Studies at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month will take you far deeper into these subjects than we can ever do in an hour of radio, even with someone as well-versed in this as Dr. Robert Kolb. The book is called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. It's authored by the late Eugene Klug. Not only the Peasants' Revolt and Social Reform are the subjects, that's a chapter, but it really walks through the initial stage of the Reformation where Luther had the greatest hand, from the 95 Theses to the presentation of the Augsburg Confession, through the writings of Luther and the other reformers, taking you through these events of history that are so significant to the church's history then and today. The book, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther, it's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October. You can order the book if you call in the next hour, Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Now, when you call, make sure you mention Issues, Etc. The book is called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October. In the next hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. The general who said that the war on terrorism, or at least he's being reported as to have said that the war on terrorism is a war between the true God of Christianity and the idol of Islam, he's issued an apology, but there are some statements that you may not have read from his apology. I'll read them for you when we come back during Open Lines.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.